Hello.
Hey, Jeff, here's Sarah. I have Abby on the phone for you.
Okay.
Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Abby. It's Jeffrey Wells speaking, Hollywood Elsewhere. I'm sorry for being an asshole and forgetting to come down at the right time.
I love that as an opening gambit. Can I call you an asshole? My God. No, not at all. Don't worry about it. It's absolutely no problem.
I also want to apologize, Abby, for not having, because I was very taken, as I told Sarah when I saw Suffragette at Telluride. I was very taken. I don't know what I expected, but I guess I was kind of hoping that it would be just good enough, you know, because I expected that Carey Mulligan's performance would be exceptional, as she always is. Mm-hmm. And I was really knocked back by how much better it was than I expected. Much better. Because I was afraid it would be like Selma. Let's put it bluntly. I was not disapproving of Selma. It was a good, sturdy film, but it was a story of a movement that kind of just told the story. And I swear to God, you guys got a hold of something by focusing, well, you can tell me, but basically you focused on, three or four, maybe four or five women who got together in a kind of a cell, and you stuck with them, and through those five, I felt, because none of them were radiantly important. I mean, they are important in history, like, but at the time, nobody knew anything, and so they were just all struggling, and that was a genius move, in my view. That's why it worked.
I think it's a genius move, or just sheer number of drafts we did that we eventually found them. Thank you for that. It really means a lot, because, you know, it's that very weird time where you're kind of sending a film out into the world, and it's a bit like waiting for a date at the prom. You're like, is it all right? But the truth is that, it did take us time to find the story. I mean, originally when I wrote it, I made the classic mistake, you know, I focused on the kind of upper middle class woman of Alice, played by Romola Garai, and I thought, this just feels very familiar. And it was only when I went back and really read and reread the testimonials of the women, they were so compelling and felt so contemporary, and I think I'd sort of felt like I'd experienced the curse of biopic. You know, I tried to take on Margaret Thatcher's life and realized it's really hard to do a biopic on such an immense life. And so I kind of knew pretty quickly that I couldn't focus on Emmeline Pankhurst and even, you know, Emily Wilding Davison. I just thought, I don't know if there was enough there for me to make a whole film about that life. And so I kept on hearing this word foot soldiers, and I thought, yeah, who are the women behind the movement? And there's a very strange thing happening with the movie, because it took us so long to get going with this film. It took us 6 years in total. But in a weird way, we were still caught up with the world changing. And, you know, there was this sort of growing social activism around us. And I think that's, you know, largely to do with the digital age, that we're more connected politically with the world now, and we see the social injustice and the obvious examples of inequality across the world. And so suddenly the kind of voices of these contemporary turn of the 20th century women have this huge resonance for me with the 21st century women. So it was quite easy then to start to go, okay, let's just focus on this small collective, this small cell,
right?
Because I'm interested not in Mrs. Panker's face, I'm interested in the women staring up at her and who they were. And so it's really that's how we sort of built it, you know, through those very real and very raw voices of the working women.
Now, just to be clear, you were speaking very expansively about the process. The upper middle class woman who was you were focusing on
was Alice's character, Romola Garai's character.
Alice's character.
Yeah, sorry, Romola's character, Alice.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yes. Okay. Romola Garai.
So originally, I wrote the whole film from her perspective, and it was about a laundress / seamstress who comes into work in her house.
Right.
And so I wrote it about their relationship, and really this seamstress emancipating and liberating this woman. And then I suddenly thought, no, actually, you know, I understand how the kind of upper middle class woman would have the time and economically would allow herself and would be able to go out. But what happens to the working class woman when she gets incarcerated for 2 weeks and comes back and finds her job is no longer there? And,
right. You
know, doesn't have any money to feed her family and can't fall back on any kind of, you know, received wealth. And so that's what took us back to the story of Maud, really. And also there was this strange thing going on, because we were looking at lots and lots of footage and lots of photos, and I saw these photos of this laundry, and they were very pristine, and there were women in, you know, black aprons and white starched collars, and I thought, well, this looks like a very civilized world to be in. And then when I started to read about the women's working lives and the amount of illnesses and burns and, kind of how detrimental it was to their health, I thought there's a real contradiction here. There's something not quite right. And of course, there were so many of those photos were set up, you know, and actually when you looked back and we started to do the research when they were building the laundries, we looked at the machinery and you looked at the mechanisms of how they worked and how dangerous they were. And it sort of suddenly made sense. And you realized there was this kind of suppressed kind of propaganda around the working woman that, you know, I had only seen the visions of the working woman through sort of images of women in factories that looked actually relatively okay. And it was only when we did more research that you realized, you know, that these women were dealing with, you know, things that women in 21st century sweatshops are dealing with.
So in the years that you guys were looking for the funding, you were changing the script as you went along. I thought, I'm very, very glad that you guys did this as well as you did. I was just say it over and over again how pleased I was that it was so much better than I expected. And one of the things that I was sort of pleased with, it's funny, but you know, you kind of expect a film made largely by women, that the men characters are going to come off as fairly venal, perhaps a little on the cardboard, black and white side. And I felt that there was some compassion, some humanity being exhibited, particularly during the second half of the film, by Brendan Gleeson's character.
Yeah.
He wasn't a monster, and that was a huge credit again to you guys, because it's more interesting when a person is conflicted and they're doing what they feel is their duty, their job, but they also feel human compassion while they're doing it. And so that was good. That was good.
Yeah, no, you're so right. I mean, Brendan's character was based on a composite of two detectives who were, deeply embedded in the surveillance movement at the time. And, you know, the actual public records weren't open until 2002, 2003.
Yeah.
And that was when you read those, you realized the extent of surveillance that these women had been under. But also, what was fascinating about these men is that, one of the men had a lot of the torture techniques that they used against the women, and, you know, the forcible feeding. You know, Emily Wilding Davison was force-fed 49 times.
Right.
Became the methodology that they took over to Ireland to try and defeat the IRA. So, you know, they were really interesting characters, these men, and I think when Brendan came on board, but certainly even, you know, when we were designing that character, you know, I wanted a man who in his own way was coming to his own kind of moment of reckoning, and he was a man who believed in the law, and then that law was being challenged. And so I'm really glad you picked up on that, and you do get that growing schism. I mean, there was a big scene that we wrote and in fact shot, which was set in Maud's apartment when he comes around to see Maud when she's she's left and she's been deserted and she's lost her child. And and, you know, he said earlier in the film, "I know you," and she does this big speech about saying, "I know you too," and she completely strips him down, whole character, based on the clothes he's wearing and his laundry and the way they've been starched. And it really reveals a very lonely man who has just given his life for his job. And for me, when he says, you know, someone is going to die for this, he feels a very direct responsibility if that happens. So in the same way as Maud is shattered and it becomes this point of change for her, I kind of hope it's the same for him. And it's a tribute to his performance that he does that with a look, because, you know, I wrote a big scene at the end where he turns up on Emily Wilding Davison's funeral, and he gives Maud a surveillance photo of her son on Tamba Sands, and there's a sort of happy ending. And in fact, I think it became much more poignant to not entirely know what would happen to those people, but just give some inkling that you knew it was a point of change for him. So I'm really glad that you got that, because I think that has been the concern. And I know when Sarah cast it was really hard, because we could have cast the women 3-4 times over, but we couldn't get men to play those parts because the agents would come back and say it's not big enough. And so, you know, I tried to make them, but they are, you know, I tried to make them as complex as I could, but they are inherently supporting roles as well. So I'm glad, I really hope that carries, and I really hope an audience gets that, so it's great.
You mentioned, of course, someone's going to die, and of course, at the end, it's a very use a real life incident that actually happened with a suffragette named Emily Davison, who is Portrayed by Natalie Press, and she comes in sort of in like the halfway mark, maybe. We get to know her more like the halfway mark, correct?
She's not... You get introduced to her when Maud gets first imprisoned in the yard.
Right. Yeah.
She very quietly drifts in, and in a weird way, I think I wanted to write about a character who goes from a place of ambivalence, militant activism, and then with the potential that someone could lose their life and move towards sort of political martyrdom. And so when we started to weave in the character of Emily, she was obviously going to, I knew that we were heading for the Derby in that actual moment, but I wanted to kind of understand it from the perspective of another character you feel could have, under certain circumstances, done a similar thing, So she's always been sort of a weird running partner for Maud, and, that was part of the challenge of the film, is trying to create sort of fictional composites of real characters and allow them to collide with, the three or four very significant moments of history that the film does,
I found the YouTube video from British Pathé, the newsreel, of the actual on my review from Telluride, and for those who have not seen the film and don't know what I'm talking about, there's the climax of Suffragette is, as I said, from history, and Emily basically killed herself by stepping in front of the horse owned by, I guess, King George V.
Yeah.
At what's called the Epsom Derby. This is back in June of 13.
Yeah.
And she steps out on the track and she waits for the king's horse to come up and grabs the horse, and it's and it's just startling that she...
Really startling. Really startling. There was an amazing documentary, actually, if you're ever interested in looking at, which they did, I think, last year by a female racing pundit presented it, called Claire Balding, and it was a recreation of that using CGI, and they were able to, using the old Pathé footage, they recreated in CGI from the perspective of Emily Wilding Davison to show what she was actually doing. And it clearly shows in that CGI that she was reaching up to try and pin the sash to the horse. And she did it at that moment because obviously it was in front of the world press. And it's the Tattenham Corner where all the press were standing. So they were aware of the political tactic and the potential press opportunity of it. But the big question mark is it a moment of reckless protest or is it a form of suicide? And I think the way we've interpreted it in the film is that it is a moment of reckless protest with a woman who is sort of aware of the concept that she may not come back alive. But it's brutal. I mean, it's brutal, that bit of footage. And, everyone aware that when I've been doing Q&As, people keep saying, was the horse okay? Was the jockey okay? And, he actually broke his collarbone, but ended up going to Emily Wilding Davison's funeral.
Right.
Because I think he was incredibly shaken by what happened, and the horse was fine. But it was Emily who eventually,
In the brutal logic of the crowd and of how news events, shocking news events like this are processed, I think that what I got is that the politicians and the voting public and just people who were paying attention to what was going on with the suffrage movement, in a strange, dark way, respected the conviction.
Totally. I think I totally agree, and I think they witnessed the women's helplessness and their despair in that moment. I think it was so shocking that anyone would do that. I mean, they were, I've seen someone jump in front of a train once, and it's so shocking, the point of impact, the sound. And when I watched the film, I thought, God, this feels like a very similar experience of just the shock of seeing that happen in front of you, that somehow it radiated and was picked up by the press and became front page news. And
right.
I think the depth of the despair became apparent. And interestingly, they didn't dismiss it in the same way as they had before, which was, it was a moment of female hysteria. I think it was incredibly sobering. And, although women didn't get the vote until 1918, 6 years on, because obviously the First World War interrupted it, it did become the point of change, I think, for the way they were portrayed in the media. And, the political cartoons of the time, there was such a huge propaganda machine that was turning over to ensure that this woman's cause would be ridiculed and undermined consistently, that to have one moment where the press were clear-eyed and said, no, this has to stop, we have to start listening to this woman, was really the legacy of that moment, of her death.
Now, just to recap again for those who are not familiar, but the women were won the vote in this country in, I believe it was 1919 or 1920?
No, in 1918, women over 30, property-owning women over 30 got the vote. And then in 1928, 10 years on, they got all women got the vote.
That's in England you're talking about.
England. Right. In America, I think it was, you started in Wyoming in 1869, and I think you went, because it went state by state. Right. I think it ended in New Jersey in 1920.
Yeah.
So you were ahead of us, actually. And it was a very different movement. I mean, your movement, you know, ran parallel and came out first out of the abolitionist movement and then the civil rights movement. It was incredibly diverse in its support. You know, the UK movement, because we weren't the diverse Britain that we are today, was much more, you know, inherently white. It's certainly white middle class, and then there was this huge working class underneath that.
Right.
There were two or three very well-known working class women at the time who went on to write about their experience. Mm. Mary Kenny and Hannah Mitchell are two. So.
Did you guys have anybody in mind for Maud once you had decided upon her as the lead?
Totally. I mean, Carrie has been in my mind to write something for her since Shame, and I just love her as a performer, and she's just so real, and I think, you know, she can strip herself back, and because this we were trying, you know, as I'm sure you know, because you've seen several period films, you know, it's very hard with period drama. I worked on The Invisible Woman last year, and you know, I did The Hour, and as soon as you do period pieces, it you have this kind of huge amount of baggage and received expectation on it. So I knew that Carrie was very good at stripping back and somehow marrying something that would be set in another time but would still feel contemporary and real. And
right.
So she was absolutely at the forefront, and as soon as I started to talk to Sarah about her, she kind of agreed. And then when we got Carrie on board, you know, everyone else fell into place, and it was Carrie who really pushed for Meryl, actually. And because I thought, God, it's just not a big enough part for Meryl, you know, having written Iron Lady for her. And actually, it's always been a gamble, but I feel, you know, using an iconic actress to play an iconic role and somebody who you would believe would become this incredible sort of, you know, head of the, you know, a sort of someone they could all adore, it sort of made sense when Meryl came on board, you know.
I thought it was, Carey Mulligan has the saddest face in the world when she wants to do that. And I just thought, between this really stirring performance and Far From the Madding Crowd and Spotlight, which I saw on Broadway for the first time last May, that was wonderful. That was fantastic.
Yeah. Skylight's amazing. No, I didn't see on Broadway, I saw it in the UK, but I thought that performance was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, to watch her make a whole sort of spaghetti bolognese from start to finish as well is sort of fascinating.
Yeah,
I think she just has this sort of still centre. And I don't know what it, you know, I often look at actors and I think, why are some actors, you know, why are some actors just made for film and others don't necessarily translate from TV, you know? And there's something that they have, and I think it comes back to, I don't know what it, actually I don't really know, I can't, but there's just some chemical thing that happens and she just has it. And I think there's a sort of an ability to be utterly transparent and expose yourself and at the same time somehow be very in charge of your whole kind of tool of acting and knowing how to gear change, and she sort of is able to do that. You know, it's sort of effortless, really.
Well, I'm just pledging openly that I'm going to be correcting my dereliction and definitely seeing Brick Lane, because I was everybody was telling me that I really was missing big time. So I'm going to see that without a doubt.
Good.
And
yes, God, that's great. Thank you so much.
Finally catching it 8 years after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see, because it was written post 7/7 and 9/11, so it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah.
You know, oddly, it still has certain resonances, certainly in terms of extremism in the UK. But
can I ask, is your screenplay going to be, as many are in the award season, going to be published in book form?
I hope so. I mean, you know, it's always an interesting thing to me, because I read screenplays more than I do books. So I've just done the conform script of it, and I've been really careful with it, because I thought, oh God, this has got to be a reading document as well as a. I hope so. I don't know. I mean, you know, I've never had any of my screenplays published.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had all my stage plays published, but I never get my screenplays published, and I read those more than anything, screenplays. So I'd love that if it was, but I don't know. I presume it will, but I don't never really know how that works.
That's become more and more of a common thing. You know, if a film is regarded as one of the better films of the year, people tend to you know, it's just a regular...
Well, it's tough, yeah, you know, there's some good stuff. I mean, I went to Telluride and I just came back blown away by everything I'd seen, you know, so, I'd feel very lucky if I managed to get that printed, yeah, I'd love that, but we'll see.
I was at that party afterwards, I wish I'd said hello, I'm sorry, but...
Oh, I wish you had, God, that was a funny party. Did you have those vodka ice cream shots? Were you at that party up in the, You came to the suffragette party.
Yeah, the Telluride party, right after the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, that was fun. I wish you had come up. Yeah. Funny evening, actually.
Anyway, that was... By the way, what's going on with Carrie's impending birth? I was told that's pretty soon.
Yeah, I think it's pretty soon. Any minute now.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure it'll be announced to the world at some point soon. Yeah. Suffragette baby is on its way.
All right, well, it's lovely speaking with you, and I hope...
Yeah, really nice talking to you. Thanks so much, and thanks for being so supportive of the film. That really genuinely means a lot.
Well, I'm glad it does, and I hope perhaps we can meet sometime down the road.
Yeah, I hope so. All right, I'll look out for you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yep.